Support for WPR comes from the Wisconsin DNR. Preventing food waste and composting scraps and uneaten veggies, grains, and fruit can help the environment. More dnr.wi.gov by searching food waste.
Support for WPR comes from Stone Harbor, a Door County resort and conference center overlooking the historic steel bridge in Sturgeon Bay. Details about hosting a wedding or conference are at stoneharbor-resort.com.
Good morning, I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you with us on this New Year's Day. Hope things are going well for you. We're going to be talking, as we traditionally do on New Year's Day, about resident and migrant birds in Wisconsin, bird counts, and a bird symposium. Noel Cutright of Ozaukee County is a former president, current historian of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, senior editor of the new Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas. Noel, thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, it's great, Jim, and Happy New Year to you and all the other listeners out there.
Thank you. And Bill Volkert, wildlife educator and naturalist with the DNR's Bureau of Wildlife Management at the Horicon-Mar State Wildlife Area, is also with us by phone. Nice to talk to you today, Bill.
Well, my pleasure, Jim, and welcome to 2007.
Yes. Noel began early this day with breakfast at Harry's Restaurant in Port Washington and then some birding along the Lake Michigan shoreline. And what did you see out there this morning?
Well, we had a nice variety of waterfowl in the harbor there at Port Washington after we had breakfast, and my first bird of the year was a coot.
That's a hoot.
Yeah, we always kind of wonder what the first bird's going to be, and we try to avoid looking at starlings or pigeons or encountering those the first bird, because we like to start off with a good one, and coot is just fine.
Now, you were doing some Christmas bird counts, I believe, last week. Is that correct?
Yes, I started out on December 14th with a Cedar Grove count, and my son and I have proceeded through several others spread around the state. We have one more to do up in Florence here on Wednesday, and when that one's done, we will have done 10 Christmas bird counts. So that's about 10% of the 100 counts or so that will be done during this Christmas season.
And this is an opportunity for people to get involved during this time of year. I know that, Bill, you will also, with Noel, be involved in the Great Backyard Bird Count.
Mm-hmm.
That's coming up in mid-February.
Right, and that's a chance for people on an internet-based system here to be able to keep tally of the birds right in their backyard. So the Christmas Bird Counts has a designated circle area where you get as many volunteers as possible and on one day try to get a tally of what's all present. The backyard bird count, of course, for the backyard, take a look at what we're seeing at that time of year, and we're able to do that across the entire United States. And so these are fun ways for people to get familiar with and challenge a little bit to identify the birds in winter. It's a good time to start bird watching because, quite honestly, it's not so confusing. All the colorful migrants are to the south, so we can start a little easier with a smaller number of birds. And with that, it does give us some reflection of the variation of bird populations from year to year, and wintertime, particularly the movement of some of the finches, where they're present, where they're not. And it looks like this is not a particularly good finch year for southern Wisconsin this year.
This January could be a replication of what happened last year in January, the warmest month, the warmest January on record in 120 years of record keeping, if I'm correct on that. Noel, what does a warm month in January do for bird populations and migration?
Well, it's kind of interesting. This year, of course, we had some really early cold weather there, and all the water froze up. And of course, we had that snowfall here in the southeastern part of the state that was a foot or more in the Milwaukee area. And, of course, now that is all gone, and the water has opened back up. So I think it chased some of the waterfowl south, but some of the spring-fed water stayed open, so we still do have a variety of waterfowl around. I know that there's a Christmas count out in the Waterloo Lake Mills area, and Rock Lake is open out there, and they got a really good variety of waterfowl. The openness of the landscape means that a lot of the birds are still dispersed over the countryside and being able to find plenty of food in their bushes and where there's fruit and seeds of grasses and other plants. So the bird feeders probably aren't quite as active as they would be if you have good snow cover. And as January comes on, I'm sure we'll get some cold weather here before long and some snowfall, which should make the bird feeders more active again. But one of the things we're seeing, again, is a variety of species staying in good numbers north that don't typically migrate, and they haven't migrated out. So we have robins and bluebirds and some high counts of species. But as Bill mentioned, we're not seeing many winter finches. We're seeing a few crossbills, both white-winged and red crossbills in the northern part of the state, but they really aren't moving down very much. So it's, again, it's one of the things that makes wintertime birding exciting, because you're never quite sure what's going to be lingering around, what snowy owl populations will be. We're getting a few, and there's been one in Madison. I know people have been seeing right downtown Madison. So it's hard to predict just because we get a warm spell in midwinter. A lot of it is kind of dictated by what happens in the fall and early winter as far as what birds it tends to induce to stay around and others that it pushes out.
And I noticed that if people are curious about bird sightings, they can go to a statewide phone number and see what has been reported. That's 414-352-3857. In the Madison area, you can use a local number of 255-2476. We'll post these numbers on Larry's website probably tomorrow when the staff gets back to work. But we're talking right now with Noel Cutright, former president, current historian of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, and Bill Volkert, wildlife educator and naturalist with the DNR stationed at the Horican Marsh State Wildlife Area, talking about the Christmas bird counts and then the great backyard bird count coming up in February 16th through the 19th. You can get more information about that at birdsource.org/GBBC for Great Backyard Bird Count. So birdsource.org/GBBC. And Bill, I noticed that last February, the ninth annual count tallied a record-breaking 623 species. So there were lots of birds to be seen.
Well, of course, since we're going across the whole United States, southern states are picking up a lot of the migrants that don't go south of the border. So our song sparrows, white-throated sparrows, things that we may have a few lingering in southern Wisconsin here in some of these early parts of the winter, that's where those populations are going. You've got a lot of the southern herons that will remain around the swamps and freshwater. And so if you go coast to coast and across the whole United States, pretty good tally. Here in Wisconsin, a Christmas bird count, say, of 25 to 40 species of birds is probably pretty average for a lot of the counts.
Mm-hmm.
And also depends on the day you get out. Of course, we had some high winds on the Horicon count and kept the birds pretty low. But if you get enough people looking, and this is really, I think, the trick of it, is whether it's across the entire state of Wisconsin or across the entire country and tallying it up, it starts to give us somewhat of a reflection of what's going on with those annual variations in bird movements.
I should give you a new number, too, for the WSO state hotline, Jim.
Okay.
It was changed this last year. It's now 262-784-4032. And that's a number that people can call in their uncommon or rare bird sightings. And also there is a recorded message there that people can find out what is being seen around the state from a rarity standpoint. So that's 262-784-4032.
All right. And if you'd like to join the conversation, it's easy. Pick up the phone. If you're in Madison, you can call us at 263-1890. Otherwise, we're toll-free at 800-642-1234. And, of course, the email address is talk@wpr.org. I know that more than 60,000 checklists were turned in last February for the Great Backyard Bird Count. That doesn't necessarily mean that 60,000 separate people turned in checklists. But if someone is interested, what can they do to become involved? Bill, I'll start with you.
Well, as you mentioned, there is a website. This is electronic-based, and simply watching the birds in your backyard around your neighborhood during that time period in February, those dates, and just giving a tally. And as people are logging in on that, and essentially the frequency of occurrence of these birds, the more often that individual species are showing up on individual counts is somewhat of a reflection of their abundance within the population. And so if you start to map this out a little bit all across the country, you'll see where these birds are, where they're not, where they're in large numbers, and where populations may be a little bit more sparse. And whether that is for year-round populations of birds, where they're distributed, and where some of these rarities may straggle to and show up, or annual variations, as Noel indicated earlier, with the weather. You know, some of these birds normally should be further south with snow and ice cover in Wisconsin. Now they're here. The waterfowl, the geese, and ducks have some access to food. They're back, and that'll be reflected within that. So it gives us a nice way to monitor what's happening out there. And the great thing about it is that with the literally millions of people in the United States who have an interest in birds, whether it is, say, a real avid hobby of seeking out rarities and driving for them or just casually enjoying the birds at the backyard bird feeder, this citizen-based monitoring is giving us a much finer resolution of the bird populations, because rather than relying on just a few scientists and volunteers to get out and try to keep track of everything across the land, everybody who's got a backyard and a bird feeder and access to the Internet can enter data, and it gives us a much finer picture of what's happening out there.
Yeah, it's kind of nice since it's only a four-day period, and it's the 16th through the 19th, and last year there were 114 species of birds reported from Wisconsin during those 4 days, and the most frequently reported bird was a black-capped chickadee. It was reported on over 1,000 checklists here in Wisconsin. Over 5,000 individuals were reported during this four-day period in February, and it wouldn't surprise me at all to see the black-capped chickadee being the most frequently reported bird again this year.
So, what this gives us an insight then, too, is certainly what birds are not only common but doing very well and adapting well to the changes in the environment. Our Christmas bird counts, I've been very interested the last few years to take a look at crow numbers. And the reason for that is we do know that crows tend to be somewhat susceptible to West Nile virus. And yet I'm surprised the very large crow population we've seen. And it looks like they seem to have either gotten by and adapted well to the that big influx of the virus that where they took a hit, or perhaps it's a reflection that we've had some very dry falls and very low mosquito populations. And, of course, our winter finch movements and so forth. These are all things we're looking at for the bird populations. I think the basis here is take a look at numbers and distribution. How are they doing, first of all? Then we can take a look at, say, causes. Which birds are expanding their range and moving? Is that because of climate change or habitat changes, land use changes? Is it, say, disease-related as something like West Nile virus comes in? Which ones may show these declines and then recoveries? And we can also take a look at, say, the Cooper's hawk, which was a threatened species in Wisconsin for years and has done extremely well in its rebounding. And, you know, it's a way to be able to monitor these changing status of birds. They're never stagnant out there. Populations go up and down over time.
Noel, if someone was interested in attracting a black-capped chickadee to their backyard, they're very quick to find a feeder, I understand. And what should be in the feeder to attract them?
Yes, they are. They're certainly a very common feeder species. On some of the Christmas bird counts that I've done this year, we'll pull up to a house, and it's really disappointing to see some wonderful feeders out in a number of these houses, and they'll be completely empty. And then we'll drive down maybe another half mile, and there will be a house that has black oil sunflower seed in a feeder, and you can almost count if there's any trees or anything at all, any kind of cover. For them, you'll have black-capped chickadees and white-breasted nuthatches and maybe a couple different species of woodpecker and maybe some mourning dove showing up and goldfinches. And you'll almost guarantee that if you're feeding black oil sunflower, you'll have several different species of birds showing up, including a black-capped chickadee. It's probably the favorite food for just a nice variety of species, including the chickadee.
Noel Cutright, Bill Volkert, our guest. Let's take some calls. There are two lines open in case you have a question that you would like to pose to either one of them. In Madison, it's 263-1890, otherwise toll-free at 1-800-642-1234. Let's go to Peg in Rice Lake. Hi, Peg.
Hi there.
What can we do for you?
Well, I'm hoping you can answer a long-term question. My dogs heard me say hi there, and now they all ran outside barking. Okay. I have been out living in the woods, more or less, for 20 years. And I put up bird feeders right away, and by now everybody is very well adapted to them, and they're here every year, everybody year-round, including cardinals. But every Christmas, after the first two, 3 years maybe, every Christmas I get almost a flock of cardinals. And I've always called it God's Christmas card because it's so beautiful and such a nice time to see them. But I think there might be some naturalist way to explain it, too. What would make them flock right around Christmas?
Bill, you want to take a stab at that?
Well, the cardinals have been expanding their range across Wisconsin over the last, say, 40, 50 years. The fact is that if you look back in the 1800s, they were barely known into southern Racine County.
Now I can barely hear you.
So the cardinal has been moving further north in its range, and it is not a migratory bird, so they remain in the area throughout the year. The cardinals, they tend to feed early in the morning, late in the afternoon, and especially when there is a good snow cover, they tend to be pushed into the feeders. And I've actually noticed the same thing with some pretty good concentration of cardinals around the feeder, especially when the snowstorms are coming. Seems that they really start to fuel up at that point. And it's my belief that actually if you get probably a fairly accurate count of the cardinals in the neighborhood in those times when they tend to be, say, flocking up and a little bit stressed. And I oftentimes will walk around at the end of the day and count how many males and female cardinals I can pick up as sort of a little bit of an annual count for the area. So it seems like they've got a high energy requirement, first thing in the morning, last at night, and with a good snow cover, it seems like everybody comes in all at once.
Noel, do you see that phenomenon as well?
Yes, I do. And, you know, there's sometimes we pulled up the one feeder at one of our Christmas counts recently and got out and kind of started pishing for them, making noise to attract them, and we had 17 cardinals pop out, about 12 males. Of course, they're easier to see this time of year. And about a half a dozen, brown females. So it was, you just never know where you're going to hit a nice flock of cardinals. They start, they're territorial during the springtime. They defend their territories. But in the wintertime, all that behavior breaks down, and they flock and get along quite nicely. And as Bill mentioned, when you get up into the Barron County, Rusk County area and the Rice Lake area, we're just starting to see cardinals show up to breed there. If you look at the Breeding Bird Atlas map, there's just part of those counties are filled with cardinals and others aren't. They're just right at the edge of the breeding range now of northern cardinal in Wisconsin.
Peg, thanks so much for the call, and I hope that explanation gives you some idea of what's going on with all those cardinals. Jim Packard in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you with us today on New Year's Day as we continue a tradition that was started with the late Sam Robbins. As we talked about ornithology and various holidays, we've continued that this year with Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert. And if you'd like to join the conversation, there's a line open. In Madison, it's 263-1890. Otherwise, toll free at 800-642-1234. Keisha Mabra is our on-air phone producer today, and you can talk to her. Let's go to Warren next in Presque Isle. Hi, Warren.
I was wondering how our mild winters would affect the migratory birds.
Like geese?
Yeah, and ducks. Because if it's so warm, they wouldn't need to migrate.
Bill, why don't you take a...
Okay. Well, I think one of the most important things to keep in mind is that bird migration is triggered by the shortening of the days. This is the signal for the birds to leave. And for birds that were kind of at the edge of their range here, like Canada geese, don't really go that far south. The big factor here of if they're going to move or not has to do with access to food. And, of course, the ducks, while they're feeding in the water, the big factor there is the forming of the ice. So as Noel indicated earlier, lakes are starting to open up in some areas of southern Wisconsin. And, of course, this morning he was on Lake Michigan shoreline watching birds because we don't get much ice out there, and there are birds that will spend the winter out on Lake Michigan. For Canada geese, when we had the heavy snow coming in around the 1st of December, we really saw a tremendous movement of the last geese out of Horicon Marsh in east-central Wisconsin. And they've basically had a reverse migration. A lot of those birds moved into Illinois, and now they've come back again. And it's really the access to food. So we tend to think of the weather getting cold and the birds are migrating south, but a lot of these birds are covered in a very good coat of down feathers, so they're well insulated, but they have to be able to get the food. So if you look at it that way, the birds that we attract to our backyard are the seed eaters, whether they're eating on wild seeds out in nature that remain or coming to the backyard bird feeder. They find food where the songbirds that are here only in summer are insect eaters. That's why they're down in the tropics now.
Warren?
So, say that really is the driving factor is access to food. And
access
right now,
to food.
You know, they're not coming to the feeders very much because there's a lot of wild food, and yet the waterfowl are finding the food out in nature.
Warren, thank you very much for your call.
Hi.
We appreciate hearing from you. And let's go next to Jillian. Let me see here. In Port Washington, where Noel, you're very close to her. Hi, Jillian.
Hi. I'm driving right now, and I know I shouldn't be talking on the phone, but I was driving through Port Washington on my way to Wabaca. And is it possible that I saw a thrush or a meadowlark?
No.
Well, it's certainly possible. We do have robins around this time of year yet. They feed on especially crab apples or even buckthorn berries this time of year, so they're almost an entirely fruit eater. They kind of move from the animal diet to the plant diet this time of year, so there are robins around. We very often will get a few meadowlarks that will stay around this time of year, so that is certainly a possibility. Of course, meadowlarks look an awful lot like starlings with their kind of short tails and plump bodies and rather large bill, so that sometimes I think people will confuse a starling not seen in real good light for a meadowlark. But, yeah, you could have seen either a meadowlark or a thrush. Robin is a thrush. We still have a few bluebirds around also. We saw Bill coordinates a count up in the northern Kettle Moraine, and we had four eastern bluebirds on that count about a week ago. So there's, of course, a few blackbirds around, too, very often mixed in with a starling flock. So you have quite a possibilities there.
He was by himself, and he had white stripes on him, so I'm pretty sure it was a meadowlark. But what? I was just surprised at this time of year to even see one.
Yeah, there's a few around, but that's a very good sighting.
Jillian, thank you very much for your call, and let's go to Clarence in Wausau next. Hi, Clarence. Clarence?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Say, I got a question. What to do with a hawk that first appeared? We feed birds in the backyard. We have about 27 evergreens around a big lot, and we have about 30 pine trees, which are 30 feet tall. A lot of cover. But a hawk come in the tree in the backyard here, and I ran out there and chased it away. But hour later, he came back, and he had the bird in his claws, and there was a head laying from a dove, I think it was. And I'm wondering, what can I do besides just clap my hands to chase the hawks away because they seem to come back?
Bill?
Well, that seems to be a pretty typical situation, and in a sense,
I can't hear you too good.
I say that's a fairly typical situation, and in a sense, you've kind of baited the hawk in by setting up the bird feeder and concentrating the songbirds. That makes hunting easy for him, which is why he's certainly taking advantage of the feeders. Probably the best trick to do, if you want to discourage him, shut down the feeders for about a week or so. Clean out the feeders, get the food out. Right now, with a lack of snow cover across much of the state, they have access to lots of natural food. As the birds disperse, the hawk's luck will start to diminish as well. He'll move on to find a new hunting ground, and you can start all over again in about a week or so. Mm-hmm. That's usually the easiest way. The other thing, I guess, is to look at it that, you know, the hawk has always been there. He's got to eat, too. He's only going to take what he needs.
Yeah.
And it's just another bird at the feeder, kind of a hierarchy. Either we can learn to enjoy it and accept that in nature, or if we think that we're being a little bit unfair to some of these birds by baiting in the hawk, shut down the feeder for a bit and wait till he moves on.
Okay, the other problem I have is neighbor's cats, even though I tell them they got so many cats, it comes over here and they try to catch a bird now and then. I know it's natural, but...
Well, that's not entirely natural because cats are not native to North America. And with the literally millions of pet owners, cats right now are starting to have what is a very definite impact on birds in terms of the losses. It's calculated certainly into the millions of individual birds that are taken by house cats. And not being a native animal to North America, the birds really are not that well adapted to avoiding that kind of a predator. And really, it's essential to keep cats indoors to protect the birds. And I know that's a tough behavior for people to try to change. And people have this feeling that cats belong outside and that's all natural. It is not. It is a serious impact to bird populations. And when we start to add up all of the many hazards for birds, from loss of habitat, contaminants out there, these introduced predators of cats, windows, car kills, tower kills, et cetera, et cetera. all of a sudden we start to see each of these being additive, and some bird populations are declining, and it's just one of many factors that is working against our native bird population. So that's one that we can actually do something about quite easily if we just learn to keep the cats indoors and make sure that they're not feeding on the wild birds.
I think it's good to talk to your neighbor and try to encourage them to keep their cats indoors. And it also, people will actually live trap cats around their feeders and contact the Humane Society and turn in the cats to the Humane Society.
Clarence, thank you so much for your call. We appreciate hearing from you. Our guests today are Noel Cutright, former president, current historian of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, and senior editor of the new Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas. And Bill Volkert is a wildlife educator and naturalist with the DNR Bureau of Wildlife Management at the Horican Marsh State Wildlife Area, which is an Ice Age National Scientific Reserve. Noel, earlier this month, you reported some great news regarding a whooping crane hatch and of the migration of the whooping cranes to Florida. Why don't you sort of update as to what's happened with the whooping crane flock?
Well, overall, we have a great record now in the nation with the number of whooping cranes that are alive, those that overwinter down in Texas and migrate up into the almost the Arctic. It's up in the north woods up in Canada to breed, plus the captive birds that we still have in a couple of different locations. And then, of course, the flock that we're establishing to hopefully breed here in Wisconsin and overwintering primarily in Florida. When you add all those numbers up, we're over 500 whooping cranes that are alive now. And the birds that did spend their summer here in Wisconsin are now down in Florida, having successfully migrated. And once again, we had young cranes that followed the ultralights to Florida successfully. We've had cranes that are now following adult cranes into Florida. And, of course, we did have a whooping crane that bred successfully in Wisconsin for the first time. And that bird moved with its parents down into Florida successfully. So we're having a variety of birds making their way between Florida and Wisconsin successfully. And I guess I can only predict that we're going to see more whooping cranes breeding successfully in the state and helping to build this eastern population. So it's just a wonderful thing to see. And it's kind of interesting this winter. We talked about waterfowl moving out, especially geese, as the weather gets colder. We actually have some sandhill cranes that continue to remain in Wisconsin. In fact, I heard a report from Aaron Holtzbeck this morning down in Arena, which is along the Wisconsin River in Iowa County, kind of southwest or west of Madison. And his first bird of the year here in 2007 were sandhill cranes that he heard calling while he was still in bed this morning.
Hmm.
So we still have a few lingering sandhill cranes in the state. And, of course, again, with the openness of our landscape, they're being able to go out and find food in the agricultural fields and wetlands in the state.
We're talking with Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert. Let's go back to the phones to Jennifer in Milwaukee. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi. I'm just sitting here on the banks of the Milwaukee River in Estabrook Park watching a lone mallard duck, a male.
Uh-huh.
But I wanted to comment, a couple of weeks ago I was in River Parkway down in West Allis, and I saw a flock of at least, I counted 28 robins feeding in a tree. I think it might have been a buckthorn tree, but I'm really not sure. All the leaves were gone. And that seemed kind of unusual. I've seen them gather like that in spring, but never this late into the year. And I just wanted to share that observation. But secondly, I'd like to comment on the cat issue. And my neighbor and I are firm believers and active in trapping cats in the neighborhood. Cats really are making a terrible dent, especially in my neighborhood. I can see bird bodies all over the place that have been attacked by cats. And I encourage people to trap the cats and to turn them in to the Humane Society. Cat owners need to learn these guys don't belong outside any more than a dog belongs outside unattended. And that's it. I love the show, and keep it up.
All right. Bill, as far as the robins go.
Well, this is an unusual year, and I think we see that as we add up all the Christmas bird counts. that, as Noel indicated before, the caller with the meadowlark, the bluebirds, robins, these birds are just not being forced further south, and unless the weather makes a dramatic change in the next 2 months here, they may just remain throughout the entire winter. So, you know, just look outside your window here. It's not typical for this time of year, and certainly the bird distribution is not typical either.
You know, in the last year's Christmas count, I believe there were over 500 robins that were sighted, and I'm just looking at the results from the Great Backyard Bird Count from last year. There were 226 robins reported on 58 checklists, so that shows a pretty good distribution. When you have 58 checklists containing robins turned in for 4 days in February, it definitely shows that they're with us.
All right, let's go to Mike next in Paris County. And where is Paris County?
Hi, Pierce County. Is up north.
I know Claire, Pierce County. I just didn't know Paris County, that's all.
Right, okay. Well, my question is, this summer, I had a great horned owl that was flying into my yard. I live on the prairie, and I do have an outdoor yard light, so it was fairly lit. But this great horned owl would come every night and feed all night, running on the ground, kind of funny looking the way they run. But he was feeding after something, and I could only narrow it down to possibly he was feeding on June beetles or maybe night crawlers. I'm wondering if you would know what he might have been feeding on. And again, he would feed all night. And I'll hang up and take my answer off the air. Thank you.
All right, Mike. Bill, you want to take a crack at that?
Yeah, that's an interesting observation because, obviously, with owls coming out at night, we don't always get to see their feeding antics. We do know that particularly Cooper's hawks during the daytime will oftentimes come onto the ground and run around after prey. I've seen them doing that even right outside the office windows at Horicon Marsh. And the owls, you know, normally will perch and wait for some sort of rodent prey to come by. Great horned owl, anything from small mice to, say, rabbits are common prey for them. But some of these unusual antics, being on the ground and scavenging or hunting for whatever's available, obviously hard to see the food source of what they're taking. But I think these are probably not that uncommon behavior if there's something that's certainly abundant at a certain time of year, but just rarely observed. And so very interesting observation. And one thing that we do note in, say, the publications for the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology are not just bird records, but oftentimes these behavioral observations. We don't know a lot about some of these birds in terms of their, say, exceptional food habits. And these are little observations that keep adding more and more to our understanding of just what these birds do.
As Bill said, that's really an interesting observation because that's pretty small prey items for great horned owls to take. It'd be more likely for something like a screech owl. I used to have screech owls come and perch and feed on June bugs or May beetles that were attracted to my outdoor light, and also the moths that would come there. So they will take beetles and moths quite commonly, but typically you just don't think of great horned owls taking prey as small as insects or as nightcrawlers, as Clarence mentioned, or as Mike mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Here's another question that deserves an observation. Why do birds' feet, why do they not freeze?
Well, I'll tackle that one. The circulation in birds' feet is quite reduced. There's not a real large blood supply there, and so they're in the way that the feet are their anatomy and their physiology of the feet just does not have a problem. Even though you'll see that some of the birds of the far Arctic, like the rough-legged hawk, will have feathering way down on the tarsus down to the feet. Snowy owls the same sort of thing. So the reduced blood flow in the feet does not cause much of a heat loss. And they just don't have a problem with those parts of their body freezing.
All right, that's a good answer. If you'd like to join this conversation with Bill Volkert and Noel Cutright, just call us in Madison at 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 800-642-1234 as we talk about resident and migrant birds, bird counts, and we'll also talk about a bird symposium coming up in February. We do have some lines open in case you'd like to get your question about birds or an observation about a particular bird answered. Just give us a call in Madison, 263-1890 or 800-642-1234. And Andrew is next in De Pere. Hi, Andrew.
Hi. I actually have two questions. The first one is here in De Pere. I own a restaurant, and I have a courtyard out back. And yesterday, some of my employees described what sounds like a small flock of cedar waxwings, and they, whatever they were, they cleaned all the fruit out of the crown of this big crabapple I have. And so I'm wondering, is that realistic that it could have been cedar waxwings?
Absolutely.
I'm not in a bustling metropolis, but there's, you know, parking lot and buildings for several hundred yards in either direction. So
that was the easy one, Andrew. That's certainly very likely. In fact, I'm sure that's what it was. And cedar waxwing will move in when they find a fruit tree that's suitable to their liking, and they'll spend days there and essentially strip all the fruit, and then they'll wander on and look for another place to feed. So I'm sure you had a flock of cedar waxwings that did that.
Oh, okay. Oh, good. Maybe they'll come back and finish the job.
Waxwings is a flocking group of birds that's always on the move, because consider that food source right now is very finite. Those are the dried fruits from last year's production, and they're just going to keep moving around from one site to the next. They find an abundant fruiting tree that still has something on it, as Noel indicated. They're just going to pound on that until that's gone, and then that flock is up and moving again to find the next one. As that food diminishes toward the latter part of the year, they'll have to move further south if it doesn't last for them. But they're definitely on the move, always looking for the next source.
And your second question, Andrew?
Well, I'm curious about anything going on with the prairie chicken population. I know that it's been in decline, probably because of the habitat being in decline. But I guess my question comes from, it seems like the DNR spends a lot of time and money stocking pheasants, which aren't native. But I'm wondering if there's any plans to stock prairie chickens.
Bill?
Well, there's no stocking of prairie chickens. What we're trying right now is to at least maintain the population, and it is currently a threatened species in Wisconsin. In the 1930s, 1940s, the population of prairie chickens was almost distributed statewide. One of the reasons was that we had, of course, the heavy logging and fires in the late 1800s across northern Wisconsin that took a forested area and opened it up. The chickens moved into that. The farming activity certainly provided habitat at that time, and we saw an expansion of the range. And then with the regrowth of forest and with loss of the native grasslands, the prairie chicken has really dwindled. And today it's found primarily south of Stevens Point and west and northwest of Stevens Point area in central Wisconsin, which never originally was a decent prairie chicken range. We have been working with a number of organizations. This was actually originally begun as a Madison-based group and Milwaukee group to save the last of the prairie chickens and to protect the habitat. Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources bought much of that land over the last 10 years and has been maintaining, through prescribed burning, an open prairie type of landscape. And so we're maintaining the population. They are existing out there on that land, but it's just a limited amount of space available that it doesn't seem to be able to expand very much. There is at least some thought that with the extensive grassland mosaic that's been established west of Horicon Marsh in a project called the Habitat Restoration Area, that perhaps we might consider a translocation of prairie chickens. In other words, a capturing of some of these birds from the wild flock and moving them to what is now becoming more suitable habitat. We're still looking into that. It was tried back in, say, the 1960s, 1970s. Those were not real successful. We moved some of the prairie chickens to the Crex Meadows area in northwest Wisconsin. They did not take well, but since that time, there have been some attempts in other states and also a learning curve of what time of year and how to do these releases so those birds will take to those areas. So we're at least maintaining them as a threatened population, make sure they don't diminish any further, and we're taking a look at the possibility of perhaps moving birds into what is now better habitat available.
Andrew, thank you very much for your call.
All right, thank you.
I appreciate hearing from you.
The other thing that should be mentioned, Jim, if I can just interject, is that there's a serious concern about the genetics of prairie chickens because of the small population size. And, you know, we really hope to be able to interject some diversity in the genetic population by bringing in some captive birds. So we're not going to be introducing them or releasing them for hunting purposes but to improve the genetics of the prairie chickens we have in Wisconsin is something definitely needs to be done and will be done.
Noel Cutright of Ozaukee County, former president, current historian of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, and Bill Volkert, our guests today. Bill's a wildlife educator and naturalist with the DNR at the Horican Marsh State Wildlife Area. I'm Jim Packard. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Happy to have you with us on New Year's Day as we talk about birding with Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert. And if you'd like to join the conversation, the number in Madison is 263-1890, the local number. Otherwise, use the toll-free 800-642-1234 number. And let's go back to the phones and to Karen in Hillsboro next. Hello, Karen.
Hi. I have a cat problem that maybe you could give me some advice, and I have to give you a little background. About 8 years ago, I bought 13 acres of land in Vernon County, and I built a little 10-by-20-foot cabin. It has no plumbing or electricity. It does have a wood-burning stove, and I live here year-round. Now, the cabin's barely big enough for me, and I noticed on the property I've planted a lot of native plants. I've been trying to restore areas with prairie and native shrubs to encourage the wildlife. I have a wonderful selection of birds out here. But there is a lot of stray cats. There are a lot of feral cats. And I talked to the DNR, and the guy in La Crosse suggested that I live trap the cats and take them to the local Humane Society because he said that they will breed to a density of 4 per acre, which on my property is 52 cats. So I contacted the local Humane Society, and they said that my township, Union Township in Vernon County, doesn't pay their payments for the Vernon County Humane Society, so they will not accept any stray cats from my township. So I can live trap them, but I have nowhere to take them. And what's more is I talked to the vets out here and neighbors, and they have the belief that the cat problem isn't a problem and that distemper and natural predators keep the cats under control and that it's not an issue and it's not a wildlife issue. It's not an issue that they want to pay money. My neighbors will not vote to have their tax money pay for the Humane Society to take stray cats. So what I've done is I've collected as many feral cats on my property as I can and made friends with them and had them spayed and neutered. I have 5 of them so far, and I can't keep 5 cats in a 10-by-20-foot cabin. So anyways, any suggestions on how to deal with this? Because they definitely prey upon. I've seen them take down every kind of bird that is out here. I mean, little chickadees and goldfinch and woodpeckers and wonderful little birds that I would not want them to catch. And I scold them when they catch the birds and praise them when they catch the rodents. And now what they do is they just don't bring me the birds, so I find piles of feathers here and there, but they'll bring me the rodents.
Well, Bill?
Well, you've got a situation on a couple of levels here. Certainly, there is the wildlife issue about the cats and their impact on birds, and there's also a little bit of an emotional issue, I guess, a bit of a denial of people not wanting to believe that cats are a significant predator. The cat's just doing what it's always been bred to do. It is a predator. And you also have a political issue here in terms of the lack of local support for your Humane Society as a repository for the stray cats. And that's something that you're going to have to deal with on a local issue. But the cat issue is one of those that I believe that there are a lot of people in kind of a state of denial. It's not only bred as a natural-born predator, but it is also people's pets. And there's an emotional attachment. And as you indicated, people are saying, well, they're under control by predators. They really don't kill wildlife. My cat would never do that. As I say, with that emotional attachment to the cats, there is a little bit of a denial out there. And I think it's very well established that cats certainly are a significant predator on both small mammals and birds. And as such, it's at least a situation we can do something about. When we talk about the other impacts to bird populations these days, some of them are difficult challenges, loss of habitat across the countryside or what's happening, say, in the tropical rainforest. There's a lot of conservation efforts going on, but the cat situation is something we really could do something about immediately, but it would take a major mindset for people, a major change there, to see them really as a significant predator and for people to for them to change their behavior to keep the cats indoors. I know that when scientists have discussed studies on the cat issue and immortality, there have been tremendous not only arguments, threats, and other things out there. As they say, it's a very hot issue, and people just oftentimes don't even want to believe the facts of it. And so that's what makes it a difficult one to resolve. But I'd say it's something that I think we could address if people could just see them in a little bit of a different light.
If you're looking for good information on this issue, and I agree with everything that Bill says, there's something that we can do with this. The American Bird Conservancy has a program that they've been working on to educate and supply information. You can go onto their website at www.abcbirds.org and click on their cats link there, and they just provide a lot of good fact sheets, posters, information for vets, information that you can share with county boards or town boards about this issue. So they just have a tremendous amount of resources on the cat issue.
All right. I guess that's about the best we can do for you, Karen. I don't have an answer for you, but good luck to you in your pursuit of an answer for your dilemma there.
Yeah, we could spend a whole program on cats, Jim.
And perhaps sometime in the future we will. We have in the past, and it's a question that doesn't seem to be answered, and so maybe we will come back and look at that again. Let's go to the next caller, who is Paul in Madison. Hi, Paul. What can we do for you?
Good morning and Happy New Year.
Thank you.
I was out in a wetland in Dane County recently and looked over 10 feet away from me were approximately 8 to 12, I believe they were great horned owls in a tamarack bush. Is that kind of a normal roost for them? It's only 8, maybe 6 feet off the ground. It's a lot of owl eyes looking at me for about 45, 50 seconds. It was quite a close encounter.
Sounds more like long-eared or short-eared.
Yeah, long-eared owl would be my guess.
Long ear. Well, they did have long tufts on their ears. I didn't find them in my bird book. That's why I have a bird book of Wisconsin. And
they look a lot like a great horned owl, but they are smaller.
Yes.
They're a little more slender, and it's an uncommon owl. It's probably the owl species that we know the least amount of any species in the state, and the roosts are quite uncommon. We used to have them in like urban Milwaukee when I moved here almost 30 years ago. They roosted in several locations in the Milwaukee metropolitan area. Now, if you find one roost in the wintertime, that's really lucky. And one thing that I try to not disturb the roosts because they're quite sensitive to people walking in into them and flushing or walking their dogs in or whatever. So if you want to observe them, try to do it from a distance and try not to flush them out of their roost trees.
Okay. It was an accidental stumbling upon them, and there they were.
Well, that's a great find, though.
It was quite amazing having that many eyes looking at me in the middle of the day.
Right.
And it was definitely a long-term roost, too.
Well, Paul, thank you very much for sharing that with us today. We appreciate hearing from you. Our guests are Bill Volkert and Noel Cutright, and the phone number for you to call to get your question answered about birds is 263-1890 if you're in Madison, otherwise 800-642-1234. And let's see what's on Don's mind in Warren, Illinois. Hi, Don.
Hi. Good morning. My favorite radio station. A couple of observations. On April the 8th, we were on Stagecoach Road, 5 miles south of the Wisconsin-Illinois border, directly south of Shellsburg, and we observed a snowy owl We got a good picture of him, just like it says in the book. He sits quiet, and we got some good shot of him. It was an adult. It seemed kind of late in the year, and it was occasional. Secondly, I take my morning walk around the block, and there's a vacant lot, and I observed two grackles and a robin anting. There was an anthill there, and I thought, what are those buggers doing? And here they were, run in and grab ants and rub it on themselves and run out, and the two species, the three birds, were doing it all at the same time. I had never seen that before. Thirdly, there's a question. I'm starting prairies, collecting seeds, and I have 2 quarts of gray-headed coneflower seeds. I wonder if they'll make good bird feed. Should I put them in a thistle feeder?
The prairie seeds, I've got a prairie here as well, and I've worked with prairie restoration for all the last 25 years on and off. There are a number of the flowers in particular that do lure the birds in, and the gray-headed coneflower tends to be a relatively small seed. Some birds will take it, such as the tree sparrows, but I think you'd be better off with the commercial seed, the much more large plump oil sunflower seed, and some of the mixed seed. I think they're going to be a little bit more nutritious for the birds. You could put it out there. I don't know how much birds will be taken, especially now with the lack of snow cover across much of the state.
And we'll pick up on your question about anting with Noel in just a moment, but we're going to stop and take a look at the news and then come back and talk with Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert about birding in Wisconsin. I'm Jim Packard. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hello, I'm Jim Packard, in for Larry Mueller today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we're talking about birding with Noel Cutright of Ozaukee County, former president, current historian of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, and the senior editor of the new Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas. And Bill Volkert is a wildlife educator and naturalist with the DNR Bureau of Wildlife Management at the Horican Marsh State Wildlife Area, which is an Ice Age National Scientific Reserve. When we broke for the news, we were talking with Don in Warren, Illinois, about anting. And Noel, I wonder if you'd pick up on anting.
Yeah, it's really an interesting, kind of a strange behavior. Over 250 different species of birds have been recorded displaying this. And essentially, they pick up an ant and hold it in their bill and run it through their feathers, primarily their flight feathers. And we can speculate or theorize that it's maybe to get rid of pests, feather mites or something like this. But we really don't have, great evidence from a scientific perspective, because there's also some species that will do just passive anting. They'll find an ant hill and essentially go in and lie down among the ants. Things like European jays and crows will do that. Blackbirds seem to be and crows seem to do a lot of anting. So it's a behavior we can observe, but we don't know exactly what they're doing. Sometimes people have thought that they grasp the ants so they will release their formic acid before they eat them. And when you see a bird anting, sometimes they'll just discard the ant, or sometimes they will go ahead and eat the ant once they've run it through their feathers a few times. So it's an interesting behavior that we don't understand its reason for existence that well.
And thank you very much for your call. And let's go next to Sarah in Mequon. Sarah, what's on your mind today?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was out walking about 3 days ago, and I was so amazed to hear a robin singing. I've seen a flock around, but with the light, the days still being so short and all, I was amazed that something would trigger that. Is that an unusual thing at all, or just a wonderful Christmas present?
Bill?
Well, the birds have both calls, which are communications, and the song. Songs, of course, are primarily given for attracting a mate in the springtime. However, as birds are going through some of the physiological changes in preparation for migration, these are hormone-driven changes that may sometimes trigger just the behavior as well of spurting out a song. We'll hear birds sometimes in fall do that, perhaps young ones even practicing a little bit to get the song ready for the next spring. it is something that they may just throw out there, but certainly it's way out from the nesting season, so we're not going to hear that continuous, repetitive type of singing when the birds are really getting serious in springtime. I think it's just an unusual type of vocalization that the birds will put out at this time of year, but it will not be that frequent. You'll just hear the occasional song or call. But again, keep in mind the different vocalizations, too, of the contact calls, warning calls. Those are given year-round. So we break.
Yes, this definitely, it was a song, and it continued for a while because I was thinking, I was imagining it, but it went on.
I guess maybe we could just shrug it off as just a Christmas present for you, just a happy robin out there.
Good.
Sarah, thank you very much for your call. We appreciate hearing from you. And let's go on to Jerry next in Waterford. Hi, Jerry.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have heard that if you put a bell around a cat's neck, that it alerts birds and it prevents them from the cat from being able to catch them and take them. I don't know if that's the case. If that's the case, would that be a possible solution to domestic cats to encourage the townships and the towns to pass an ordinance requiring a bell on a cat?
That will help to a certain degree, but cats learn to cope with noisy bells, and they can they're such good stalkers, and a lot of times they'll just stalk very close or just realize where there's some bird activities, and they'll just go and wait. So they're not really moving, and then when they do move, they just make a rush for the birds that might be feeding on the ground. So I guess it might be some help in certain cats or certain situations, but there's many situations where bells just are not that effective.
Jerry, thank you very much for that inquiry. Let's go to Russ in Appleton. Hello, Russ. Oh, I guess I should probably do this. Go, then you can go ahead, Russ.
Hello, and thank you for taking
sure,
my call as well.
Sure.
Yep. Again, I have two questions real quick. I'm having problems with the woodpeckers eating my cedar siding. I'm sure they're after some bugs, and some insecticide would probably help. But I'm just wondering if there's anything else that might deter them. And then secondly, I'm curious as to whether a peregrine falcon would be indigenous to my area, because I was real sure I saw one in my neighbor's bird bath earlier this fall.
Bill?
Well, as far as the woodpeckers, that is a serious potential problem. They can do quite a bit of damage to the house. And the best thing there is to try to break them from that habit. It's tough if you're going to work every day and they're pecking away whenever you're not home. I've got wood siding. If I hear them tapping on the side of the house, open a window,
yeah.
I'll slam on the side of the house, you know, with my hand, try to move them away. You could try a little Mylar strips, kind of a shiny plastic. Put it out there
okay.
So the wind will move that as a kind of a scarecrow. But try to discourage those birds from that house because over time it can lead to, you know, certainly if not just structural damage to the house for water getting in, but certainly the aesthetics, all those little peck holes in the house. So, yeah, you've got to break them of that habit.
And okay. As far as the peregrine falcon?
Peregrine falcon, they're a wanderer around Wisconsin. We do have some nesting artificial platforms that were put up along the Great Lakes area and over on the Mississippi River. But as a backyard bird, more often than not, I would think it would be the Cooper's hawk. It's got a somewhat similar build, not the pointed wings, but short rounded wings, but that long, sleek build to it with a long tail. And it's a more likely bird in the backyard than, say, a peregrine.
And would you go along with that, Noel?
Most definitely. I'm almost be positive be a Cooper's hawk. And as far as control methods with woodpeckers, if you can, visit the Cornell Lab of Ornithology's website. They have the best information out there on what it looks like and different kinds of sighting that affects, but they also have an excellent section on control methods.
Let's talk a little bit about the event coming up February 23rd and 24th in Port Washington. The Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, the Citizen-Based Monitoring Network of Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Bird Conservation Initiative, and the Wisconsin Audubon Council are sponsoring Symposium 2007, Recent Developments in Wisconsin Ornithology, February 23rd and 4th at the Country Inn and Suites Hotel in Port Washington. Talk some about what will be going on there, Noel, and why it's important for people to be there.
Yeah, I'm really excited, and in fact, there's some experts from around the state will be talking about some of the topics we've talked about today. There's a talk on how small birds survive Wisconsin's winters. And we have talks on both sharp-tailed grouse and what's happening with prairie chickens in the state. We're talking about shrikes, black terns, how to monitor for birds, just a lot of presentations on Friday and Saturday also, how we're trying to monitor owls in the state, red-shouldered hawks. I'll be giving the keynote talk on Saturday morning on the Wisconsin's Breeding Bird Atlas. And we're going to be recognizing some of the folks that really helped out with the Atlas with some special awards. And it's just two full days of talking about birds and what's happening with research and monitoring in the state. And it's a good time of year for, just kind of take not a lot of field work is going on that time of year, and it's a great chance to do it. As you mentioned, you can get information on the WSO website at www.uwgb.edu/birds/WSO, or you can contact Christine Reel at 262-547-6128 for information about the program and for registration. Registration is very reasonable, like $35, I think, for the two-day event.
Okay, and we'll post the phone number and Christine Reel's email address and Wisconsin Society for Ornithology's email website address. We'll post that on Larry Mueller's webpage this week so that if you don't get a chance to write this down, and you probably aren't, then you'll have a chance to go back and see what you need to do in order to attend Symposium 2007. It does sound like it's going to be a great time. And while we're at it, let's talk a little bit about the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas. We had been promoting it for years, and it finally came true last year with the release of the Breeding Bird Atlas. And, Noel, what exactly is it?
Well, it's a book that describes the distribution of where all the birds that breed in Wisconsin are. So it's an up-to-date distribution, but there's all kinds of other information there about the habitats the birds were found in and some idea of their history. And it's over a 600-page book that took about a decade to put together. It came out in May, as you mentioned, through the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. Sales have been very good. I think we're up around 2,000 books sold since in the first 6 months it's been out.
It's a very big book, too.
It's a big book. It weighs 5 pounds. There's a lot of color in it. And again, you can get information from Christine Reel or from the WSO on how to obtain it. It's a $40 book. And I would urge some people receive copies for Christmas. And I know I autographed several books that people are going to give for gifts. And hopefully people are enjoying it. They've had an opportunity to obtain a copy.
So it's www.uwgb, for UW Green Bay, .edu/birds/WSO for the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology.
Right.
And let's go to the phones again and to Loretta in Eau Claire. Hi, Loretta.
Hi. I know bird calls and so forth and even taken a class, but I don't know how to tell what a crow's nest looks like.
Bill, you've seen a lot of them.
Yeah, crow. Well, as abundant and widespread as crows are, they do a good job of tucking those nests away. Commonly in the middle upper portion of conifer trees, so good concealment. They're also a relatively early nesting bird. March, April tend to be the months where they're constructing those nests. And so before a lot of the migrants even get here, they're already incubating their eggs. And the one thing to be looking for any of these medium-sized nests, and whether that is a crow, a green heron, a Cooper's hawk or something like that, birds are going to be using sticks for the outer portion of the nest. Squirrels are using leaves. So it'll be a stick structure, and then there'll be a lining on the inside of the nest, which, of course, from the ground is going to be hard to see.
So about how high from the ground?
Concealment.
About how high from the ground?
They will be, say, 20 to 40 feet or more, and usually tucked away in a pretty good shelter of dense conifer if they can find it.
Well, thank you so much.
All right, Loretta, thank you very much for your call. And on to Christy in West Bend. Hi, Christy.
Hello. How are you doing today?
Very good. Thank you.
Good. I have a question. I've lived in Wisconsin for about a year and a half. And since I've lived here, and I don't know if this is just me or... But I have had quite a few pheasants. I think they're pheasants. I am not a big bird person as far as identifying them, run out and I hit them. And I, you know, I'm not in the ditch and I'm staying on the road, but I don't know if, is that like something that can be common with like a ground bird, like a pheasant or?
No.
It's not that uncommon to see ringneck pheasants killed either by running across or flying low across roads. And if you're in an area where there's active stalking by a conservation organization of some kind, or the DNR has been stalking a wildlife, one of their wildlife areas, it's not uncommon at all to see ringneck pheasants dead along the roadsides. But I wouldn't think you should be hitting a lot of them unless you're in an area near a game farm, maybe where they're escaping, or like I say, there's been some really active stalking and the population is really high. But
yeah.
Road kills are not that uncommon.
Okay. I mean, it's been about six or seven of them, or like seven or eight. And it's just like, is it me? Am I just bad luck with birds? I just didn't know. I have never experienced it. I used to live in Colorado, and you'd see them, and they'd usually either take flight or they'd run the other way. But
what?
And so it's just kind of like, what is it with the birds out here?
Well, it seems like some of the stock birds tend to hang around roadsides, and they come out for gravel also at times for using their gizzards. And I know I had one rooster that I saw along the roadside every day for two or three weeks, and it seemed to be pretty cognizant of the traffic going by, but you think sooner or later that the bird may end up getting hit.
Bill, have you had that experience as well?
Well, as Noel indicated, some of these birds, as stock birds, they tend to have a little bit different habit because they're reared, first of all, in captivity and then released into the wild. And so I think sometimes their behavior, they're just not always as sharp from predators. And this habit of picking the gravel on the roadside, it does somewhat set them up. If they go the wrong way for cover or across the road, they could be vulnerable that way.
Noel Cutright, Bill Volkert, our guests. If you'd like to join the conversation, there are a couple lines open in Madison at 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 1-800-642-1234. And on to Mike in Castle Rock. Hi, Mike. How are you today?
Pretty good. Question I've got is this. I have not seen a northern shrike this year, and not quite as many rough-legged hawks. But my question is, because it's been so warm here, I've not seen any tree sparrows. And I've got a prairie restoration project going on here, and typically I see them this time of year. Not a lot of them, but I see a few.
Well, I think those are all good observations, Mike, that you've made. There are some northern shrikes around. They tend to be kind of spotty. I've seen them, I guess, on about half of the Christmas counts that I've done. Rough-legged hawks have had really poor production the last couple of years, up in Canada and into Alaska, and we're just not seeing many young birds being produced, and therefore I think the population has been reduced on rough-legged hawks. And again, I think because of the openness, some of these birds are probably staying farther north than what we would normally see. So it has not been a good year for rough-legged hawks in general. And tree sparrows also tend to be very spotty this year. I've gone some Christmas counts, and you'll have a hard time finding four or five, even though I did find a flock of about 65 the other day out by Poisipi on the Fremont count. But with the openness of the landscape, they can just be so widely distributed. But in general, has not been a good tree sparrow winter so far.
Would that also apply to red-breasted nuthatches?
Red-breasted nuthatches are here in pretty good numbers this year for the most part. I know some counts have done quite well with red-breasted nuthatches, but I think they're kind of sporadic in their occurrence. This year in Wisconsin, you have some areas where there's good numbers, other areas where the numbers aren't what you would expect.
So then saw-whet owls would also be down?
I don't know. Saw-whet owls are so poorly sampled or looked for this time of year, we don't really understand what their winter distributions are too much. I know there's some around, but I guess I don't have a real good feeling right now until I see the Christmas bird count results come in about what their populations are this winter compared to past winters.
Mike, thanks very much for your observations and question. And let's go to Chuck in Hartford next. Hi, Chuck.
Hi. I have two things. The first is that I have a question about bird feed, but the first thing I want to mention is that where I live, there's no homes around me, and there's quite a few different kinds of birds. And this past year, since the spring, you know, there were some birds that had nests and stuff like that. And when they'd be out in the trees singing and stuff like that, I would try and mimic them, I mean, as best I could, which is not very good. But I'm surprised at how many would, like, pay attention and like, chirp back to me. And what I do is that once I get them interested, I'll wait for them to chirp to me, and then I'll say something back to them, you know, as far as following their type of chirp as best I can. And I'll find within a half hour other types of birds will come around too, and it kind of draws them in, and it's amazing to me. I wonder if you've ever heard people doing that. And the other thing is that I have a question about bird food. I had a type of wild finch bird food that was bringing in all kinds of birds to my bird feeder, and now I switched to more expensive bird food, and I don't have any birds, and I'm wondering what happened, you know?
You got to call them in. Who would like to pick up on this?
Well, I'll mention a little something on the bird calling. Trying to whistle or call back to the birds, I mean, certainly they're very vocal and they're tuned into that. It's difficult for us to really well imitate an awful lot of the birds. Just the vocalizations are so rich and varied among the birds. But Noel made a mention of this earlier. When you're out looking for birds, something that's very effective that a lot of bird watchers do is called pishing. And it tends to stir up the flock. The chickadees tend to come quite readily to it. And it's a common technique where you can kind of get the birds moving, either get their curiosity to get them to jump up and where they're visible, or actually call them in. And it's just a simple kind of a wishing sound, just a psh, 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 psh. And it's amazing how these birds will pick up on that. And as I say, if you're trying to get a sample of what's out there, they will jump up from the bushes to get a view, or oftentimes come right in, and it's a very effective way.
And there's
to
actually
stir up that flock and bring them in.
A new book out on the art of pishing is the title of the book by Pete Dunn. So I received a copy of it from Pete. I met him at a meeting this fall, and I haven't had a chance to look at it yet, but it's common enough and interesting enough that he's written a book about it.
So is it the art of P-I-S-H-I-N-G?
Correct, by Pete Dunn, D-U-N-N-E.
Okay, very good. And his other question had to do with the bird feeder not attracting birds. Is it just a cyclical kind of thing that occurs?
Well, he might have switched foods right when we had the change in the weather, too, because I know our bird feeders are probably maybe a third or a quarter as active as they were when we had the snowfall. And so it may be a coincidence. It may be the selection of seeds in there, even though it was more expensive seeds. Maybe the ones he was using before were more preferred by the species. So I guess I'd really need to know more details.
All right, Chuck, thank you so much for your questions.
One thing I'd like to interject before we leave.
Yes.
The Wisconsin Bird Conservation Initiative, through the DNR, has been working on the Great Wisconsin Birding and Nature Trail.
Mm-hmm.
And in December, their third guide in the series came out, and this covers the counties along Lake Michigan. And this is a wonderful, like, 60-page guide on where all the good birding spots are along the Lake Michigan shoreline from Kenosha all the way up to Florence. And it can be obtained from the State Bureau of Tourism at 1-800-432-TRIP, or you can visit their website, which is www.travelwisconsin.com. And you can either order a free copy or you can actually download a copy. So this is a third of what will eventually be five regional guides that will cover the entire state. And the Lake Michigan one is just terrific.
And one question from Mary in Madison. If you have a neotropical bird, why is it called neo? And I'll let Bill answer that.
Well, what they're referring to is the New World tropics. The European, African part of the world, referred to the Old World or Paleo, Arctic Paleo tropics. These are the neotropics, are the New World tropics. So essentially it's the Western Hemisphere referring to Central and South America.
Bill and Noel, thank you so much. It's been a really fast-moving hour and a half. We've learned a lot and had a lot of fun.
Well, it's a nice way to kick off the year, and I hope everybody starts a good year of bird watching. Keep a list.
And to you, Noel. Thanks very much for being here.
We always enjoy it.
All right. Resident Migrant Birds, Bird Counts, and the Symposium. Noel Cutright, Bill Volkert, our guest. We'll have the addresses and phone numbers that we mentioned up on Larry Mueller's webpage sometime this week, once the staff gets back to work. Tomorrow, Peter Green of Madison will be in and talking personal computing here on the Ideas Net.